Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, I'd like to kick off the episode with a question directed right at you. When they adapt movies from novels, and you happen to have read said novel, are you A, happy, yay, I'm going in and I know the story, can't wait to see what they did to the book, or B, are you like, aw, man, they're just going to ruin the book. I wish I was going in blind. I don't want to know because they're just going to ruin the book.
I don't go in with low expectations. I try and go in with high expectations. I tend to find that having read the book fills in plot holes sometimes that appear in the film. And I'm always really excited when a movie is satisfying and lives up to the book and does the book justice. And yes, if it's the opposite and I watch a film and I'm really disappointed, then I drive people back to read the book instead.
A lot of times, this is the case with the film we're going to talk about first today, the rhythm section. I read the novel. And in this case, and in many cases, I wonder, would I have enjoyed the movie more if I didn't know everything they took out and condensed and deleted? Because they did. The novelist actually adapted the screenplay, so he's adapting his own work, and it's tough to do. I can see why he deleted what he did, and he condensed characters, and he took out entire plot lines. I almost think I may have enjoyed this movie more if I didn't know all that, if I didn't have all that backstory.
But I haven't read the book, and so I can tell you right now that I think it might have served me better to have known the backstory, because I don't think this plot worked. I think there were too many holes for the, you know, average person coming in having not read the book. I don't think the story tracks properly, and I wasn't buying it. And so I feel that maybe this is one of those cases where I really came out of it thinking, well, maybe if I had read the book, I would have sort of subconsciously filled in the gaps, much as I've done with other films where I did read the book first.
There are glaring plot holes. In fact, I took members of my book club with me to the screening, and afterwards we were saying, you know what? They didn't explain this. How would anybody know what this means? Because they didn't talk about it, but we know what it meant. So we're talking about Mark Burnell. He was the novelist. Now he's the screenwriter, and his book came out in 1999 about a prostitute assassin. That's why I read the book, because I pitched it as, let's read about a prostitute assassin.
I just think it was so cute that there were these three guys sitting next to me who read this book in their book club. That's just so unusual for me to see. It was so nice that it wasn't the mommy influencers that were around me. It was the dudes from the book club that had read this book.
That's right. And the book spurred a series. There's four of these about Stephanie. I mean, about Lisa. I mean, about Petra. She has multiple identities. Stephanie Patrick, played by Blake Lively, in a very
fun Blake Lively-ish role.
It is. She did a Charlize Theron transformation. It's her, but man, it's like ugly Blake Lively.
It's not a transformation. It doesn't fit her. It didn't, like, to me, I just felt that it was really miscast. So I guess if you've read the book, you might have a better sense of whether she fit your vision of what that Stephanie Patrick character looked like in your head when you're reading the book.
Well, no, she didn't look like Blake Lively. But the rhythm section had an arduous adventure to get to the screen. It not only was production delayed because Blake Lively shattered her hand on Jude Law's elbow, delaying production a full 6 months, but then its first release date got pushed back. Its second release date got pushed back. It was going to be released last October. There was awards buzz. Ooh, Blake Lively, as you've never seen her before. She's ruthless now, and she's playing all these different roles and different parts. And then it got kicked back to late January. The dagger, the sign of signs, and it's correct. And whatever studio executive finally saw it and said, no, this is not going to be our awards push. Move it to January. And he's right. The rhythm section is let down. It's stale. We've seen Revenge's tricky stories before. Mm-hmm. It's the anti-Jason Bourne. She wants to do Jason Bourne things. She wants to walk into the room, take out the guy she needs to take out, and leave. Boom, in and out. And she's just terrible at it. She's terrible.
Well, I think it's still a Jason Bourne wannabe. They jet off to all these different locales, and even the Jason Bourne films, there's still some sense of humanity in the character, and so I don't think she's an anti-Jason Bourne. I just think that it's
I said it because Jason Bourne is very good at what he does. Yeah, he's very good.
Well, but the movie is very good. The Jason Bourne films, in terms of pacing and character development and plot, just have a lot more going for them than this particular one did. To me, the transformations, yes, this is a very different kind of role for Blake Lively, but that's why I don't think it's a Blake Lively role, because I'm not sure I believe her as this smart young woman who then, when her family is killed in a plane crash, she sort of, gets spirals out of control and into this world of prostitution and drugs. And then after that, she discovers that, oh, that plane crash was not an accident. She sort of emerges from her sea of despair to go and fight the bad guys and kill them all, and becomes like this trained assassin. Those transformations all the way across the board, the believability factor just wasn't working for me.
Stephanie Patrick feels such an overwhelming sense of guilt. She blames herself that her family, her two parents and two siblings, were on this plane that crashed. She says she thinks it's her fault. Therefore, what can she do to herself to atone? Well, she takes herself out of Oxford and she transforms herself into a drug addicted, we're talking heroin here, the good drugs, into the worst prostitute ever. She said, that's what I can do to make things better. When a journalist drops by, says, hey, they didn't crash accidentally. This wasn't a mechanical failure. Someone put a bomb on their aircraft. And okay, now she's like, well, tell me who it was. I want to go kill them now. She makes mistakes. Things happen. She winds up with Jude Law in middle of nowhere, Scotland. He has a much bigger backstory in the novel.
I figured as much.
And they would actually explain why there are army barracks on his land. That's one of my things. Like, the movie didn't tell you why she shows up into this like training mm-hmm. center where there is nobody.
She just shows up. It's like Rocky being out in Siberia, you know?
Yeah, Jude Law, he's ex-MI6. He got in trouble, I guess. Now he's a loner, and he apparently hates her, but he trains her in marksmanship and driving skills and sends her off on missions, missions to kill the people behind the airplane bombing. It's a dour misfire.
It is a misfire. The rhythm is off throughout this entire film.
Well done,
It
Hannah.
Really is. I was like, okay, how do I describe this? It's like the rhythm section has no rhythm. That was the biggest problem. And I do think people are like, why is it called the rhythm section? Well, think of your heart as the drums and your breathing as the bass. That's supposed to be your main takeaway, is that you use this music metaphor to describe how to control your heartbeat when you're off killing somebody. So I don't know. I mean, but it just, that's the intent, is that there's this rhythm that you're supposed to be able to put yourself into and put your body into to control your emotions. And then she sort of set out on the world to take on the role of this femme fatale assassin. And the other complete miscast I felt in this film, and maybe this is another one where you can tell me if in the book you had a different perspective of who this character was supposed to be, but you've got Sterling K. Brown as this information broker that ends up in a rather bizarre relationship with this character, with Stephanie. What was his character supposed to be like in the book? Because I did not feel the connection between them that I guess they try and show through like little flashback snippets, and it did not track for me at all.
Brown's character, Mark Sarah, in the film is actually a composite character. There's a couple He's not like his novel character. I did not imagine Sterling K. Brown, by the way. He's much more ruthless in the novel. Much more ruthless. Here, he's almost romantic at times. That is not his character. I don't know if he was, you know, he played it just fine, how it was written, but his character comes off terrible.
Yeah, his character really just did not work for me, and I wasn't feeling any kind of chemistry between these two. And so, you know, I kept thinking, you know, he's had such a strong year with, like, Waves. You know, when you think about having seen him in Waves, that such a presence in that film. I just felt this was just a really bizarre role choice. It just didn't work for me. And the only one that I really felt was potentially cast properly, Jude Law felt like the right kind of cast for that one. And I wish... I really wanted to see more of Raza Jaffrey as the journalist who finds Stephanie and clues her into the information about the plane crash and the plot and kind of sets her on this terrible path. But I was really liking him, and then things happen. But so I wish we had been able to see more of Raza Jeffrey.
Naturally, they share a bit more time together in the novel than they do in the film. Did you notice the rhythm section has a sponsor? I was thirsty a little bit when I
went
in.
You noticed. I did not notice.
And I saw the delightful smiles after a drink and the dripping chalices of golden Stella Artois. What product placement in your face? And you're like, oh my God, I want a Stella right now.
I was more caught up in things like, is Blake Lively trying to speak with a British accent? Is she British? Is she not British? Is she an American who was in Britain and suddenly was
I'm glad you brought that up. In the book, she's American. But in the film, she's quite British.
And yet her accent comes and goes. And so I had, that was a part of the problem that I had. I was like, wait a second, now it's Blake Lively trying to speak with a British accent. And I was like, is that part of the character? It was weird to me. It didn't really work. So while you were thinking beer, I was thinking accents. And I was thinking that I really, you know, whenever these films have a female director, I want to be able to promote them. And I had seen some stuff with Reed Morano, who's the director of this, and she is, I guess, best known really for TV directing for The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, I guess she directed the big ones, the pilot. The first two episodes.
Right. And so, you know, you wanted her to succeed with this, especially when there's all the controversy sometimes about there not being enough money thrown behind female directors and projects, and kudos to them. But I think she makes some choices that just don't really work with them. She makes a very conscientious choice to shoot this film much more close up, intimate than a Jason Bourne film would be. And the series of tight shots and things, I understand that she's trying to bring you into getting the perspective, the point of view of Stephanie as she's on these missions. But I did not really feel that works for this kind of film. It's like either you're trying to be this big, beautifully shot, you know, epic locations around the world, Jason Bourne kind of thing, or you're a more intimate drama. And so it didn't find a rhythm with either one of those.
It lacked a rhythm section?
It lacked a rhythm section.
All right.
From beginning to end.
we have beat the rhythm section to death.
Ba-dum-bum.
Don't go see it. the rest of this podcast is going to revolve around the Oscars, but we're not doing our picks yet. That'll be next week. We're talking about the categories everybody foams at the mouths over and waits for the Oscar telecast to get to. The short films, the three categories of short films, animated, live action, and documentary shorts. I look forward to these all year because they're awesome. Hardly anybody sees them because they're hard to see. They don't air them at movie theaters, you know, they're at...
A few, although one in particular...
Well, animated sometimes, yeah. Pixar, but, you know, you see them at film festivals, you see them now on YouTube, some are on Netflix. They're more accessible now than they were when we were coming of age.
And more theaters are showing them. They are having special presentations sometimes in the bigger cities, for sure. of the shorts, a little marathon of shorts viewing. And I actually do look forward to these every year too. And they've become one of my favorite categories to try and predict because they're perfect short attention span theater movies.
That's your style.
Sometimes. But I do feel sometimes a movie can be told better in 15 minutes than some people have done in a 2-hour epic feature. And so I always appreciate that ability to tell a good story really well in a much shorter period of time. And these are always just a unique, it's a mixed bag. And it's like comparing apples and oranges. I have a really hard time ever trying to pick the winners because you can't really, you just can't decide on a very consistent basis which movie might be better for which reason, because they are just so broad in their approaches and in their style. And that's what makes them fun to watch, but it also is what makes it, to me, more of a challenge to try and figure out who will actually win.
Picking winners in the short film categories is notoriously challenging. They lack the buzz of feature films, and other than the animated, which usually goes to Pixar if they have one, you just kind of go with your gut feeling. Maybe if this one was my favorite, it will be everyone else's favorite. A lot of times I do get them wrong, because it's a crapshoot. So let's start with the animated short films. Unlike years past, the animated films this year are quite sad. A couple people I read online were crying. Usually they're not. They're not necessarily happy, but they're chippy, they're chirpy, they're uplifting. These are very family-oriented, very weighty issues. And I want to say my personal favorite this year is a film called Hair Love. A little African-American girl has wild, untamed hair. She's trying to fix it. She's looking at a vlog, like a YouTube thing, on how to do certain hairstyles. She needs dad's help. Dad is useless. Dad can't do it. And there's frustration. They figure it out, and then there's a reveal at the end of that will tug on your heartstrings.
Yeah, I don't think these movies are sad so much as they're heartfelt. They're all kind of melancholy in their, you know, in their vibe. And I don't know. I feel like I have seen a lot of sad ones over the years, so it wasn't a surprise to me that there'd be as many films as there are that would fall into that kind of sad, melancholy category. But I agree with you. I do think Hair Love has the edge. If I had to pick one, also because Hair Love has, aside from it being a USA film that's just had much wider exposure, I've seen the people behind this film out and about in marketing. And apparently this was a short that was shown in theaters in front of some kids' movies. And so I know people who actually have seen this one. And so I do think that this one has the biggest exposure, will likely win, and just for a variety of reasons. But it's, again, it's just one of those really tight-knit, in a nutshell, has a beginning, a middle, and an end, has a twist, and is just very sweet. And I think a lot of people, it will just resonate with a lot of people. So I did enjoy it. There was definitely a family theme, as we had mentioned earlier, across all of these. But when you have some that are French and Czech, those are certainly on the artier side, I would say. Whereas Hair Love is more accessible, I think, to the masses.
While Hair Love is American, it's not Pixar. And there is a Pixar in one in here. It's Kit Bull. Kit Bull is a bit more visceral than your standard Pixar. There's animal abuse involved in dogfighting. Yeah. It is about, you know, making your own family and, you know, opposites can look out for one another. It's cute.
It is cute.
I put it 3rd out of 5, but I don't see it winning anything.
I don't think it'll win, but I think people who do get to see it, especially pet lovers, it will resonate with them because it's this mangy kitten who basically takes under its wing this abused pit bull across the way, and they escape together to find their happily ever after home. And so it's very sweet.
All right, live action short film. Not as dour as last year. Last year was a gut punch and it would rip out your intestines on the floor, is how hard last year's live-action films were to watch. This one was a breath of fresh air. I mean, some of these are really hard to watch still, but nothing compared to last year's atrocities. Personally, my favorite... I have no idea, by the way, what's going to win this category.
Yeah.
It can go in any other of these five... Well, four, because one of them's definitely not going to win. But my personal favorite is Saria from Guatemala. It says it's based on a true story. I did not know about this story. In fact, if you do not know about this story, don't look it up before you see it, because it is such a twist. What happens? I didn't see it coming. It knocked the wind out of me. But we're talking about a girls' orphanage in Guatemala. They are abused. They are maltreated. There's an escape. They are recaptured, and that's all I want to say about it. I just said I'm so blindsided about what happens in this story that I would love feedback on anyone else who has seen Saria.
I vaguely remembered hearing about the story, the tragedy that unfolded at this particular orphanage, and that with these teen girls. And so, yes, it's one where I don't really necessarily want to give it away. But if you were familiar with the story and you know about it, because it was not that long ago, I think it was like around 2015.
Yeah, it was a couple years ago.
2017. It was not long ago at all. And so there is a tragedy that takes place, and the film is really dedicated to the girls. And so it's I think it has a possibility of winning. The one that I thought was going to be my least favorite when I started watching it turned into the only one that made me cry in the end, and that was The Neighbor's Window. Takes a turn that I was like, wow, okay, I wasn't quite expecting it to go there in the first 5 minutes watching it. I was kind of like, okay, this is going to be, you know, my least favorite of the bunch. But it turns out it's one of those, the grass is always greener. You have this sort of yuppie couple with their kids realize that these new neighbors that moved in across the street, a young couple just starting out, and they're, it's sort of like the naked guy from Friends, you know, they're like looking across going, don't these people realize they need some curtains because we can see right into their apartment? And so it's really about the voyeuristic nature of sort of then the obsession of this mom sort of having to always wonder what's going on with these neighbors across the way and how perfect and, you know, their lives look. And then something happens to make you realize that, you know, that you don't always really know what's going on behind even an open window, and just how it's about having these windows into each other's lives. And in the end, I found it had some real emotional pull, and it just turned for me. And it's one of those surprises that I really kind of got got a bit welled up there at the end.
I enjoyed it. It's my 3 out of 5. I saw the twist coming about halfway through. I picked it up.
I saw it coming, but it still worked.
And it's well done. They complete the arc that they're aiming for, and it's a good message. Appreciate, you know what? You have it pretty darn good. Appreciate what you have.
Exactly.
The other one that I thought was quite enjoyable was one called Brotherhood. It takes place in Tunisia. This man's son comes home from joining ISIS in Syria, and he brings a child bride home with him, and it's about reintegration, hurt feelings, old feelings, buried feelings. This family's got some tough times ahead of them, and I thought it was really well done.
Yeah, no, I actually liked everything in this category. For me this year...
Oh, really? You liked Nefta Football Club?
Nefta Football Club was the weakest of them. That was just these two football fan brothers who come across a drug mule and take it home and then, you know, figure out what to do with the drugs. It's kind of ridiculous, but it was harmless, and it was like just one of those ones that you go... Okay, that was okay. A Sister is one that immediately I was like, this, we saw this already.
Sister stole its plot.
I'm like, we've seen this story. This is a like 15-minute version of the story that we saw.
The Guilty,
which I believe was Dutch, maybe?
It was Danish.
Danish, about a emergency services dispatcher who is listening in on a who's on a call with a woman who you believe has been kidnapped, and trying to find her before it's too late. And so this live action called A Sister is essentially the exact same plot in a nutshell. And it's a female emergency services dispatcher, and she's trying to figure out what's going on with this woman who's calling from a car, who obviously can't speak freely and is trying to provide clues to get the cops to understand where she might be and to help her. So same exact plot as The Guilty, and not nearly as good. I mean, The Guilty was one where
it
benefited from being longer because you are in it, and it just took some twists. So while I appreciate what a sister was trying to do, it's been done better. So I would say that Saria has a possibility of getting there if people are sort of in tune with that based on a true story.
Play it safe. The neighbor's window is going to win.
I would say the neighbor's, and I would personally, if I had to vote right now, I would vote for the neighbor's window.
No, sorry is much better, but be safe. Yeah, neighbor's window. The documentaries, I enjoyed, 4 out of 5 of these. I always look forward to the short docs. They're just so punchy, and you never know what you're going to get. So my personal favorite, and one I actually think will win the category, is Learning to Skateboard in a War Zone, parentheses, If You're a Girl. We're in Afghanistan, and we're talking about a non-governmental organization called Skatistan. The international skateboarding community funds this NGO to teach young girls, about 7 to 12 years old, how to skateboard. Well, they teach them how to read and write as well, but skateboarding gives them confidence. Girls are not allowed to skateboard in Afghanistan, naturally, because they're not allowed to do anything in Afghanistan. And these girls, time is running out, because when they turn 13, they're going to be housebound, shut up in their house, waiting, to be married when they're 16. So right now, enjoy it, because this is the one time in your life you get to learn how to read, how to write your name, and how to do something they will probably never get to do again, which is skateboard.
Yeah, this one sort of reminded me a little bit of the reason I think it could win is for the same reason that last year's documentary on the girls with the doc about periods that we knew,
which was our favorite,
and did win. Yeah. So it's very possible that for some of the same, because of the themes of female empowerment, that could be still top of mind for some Academy voters if they happen to see this one too. And people can actually go and learn about this organization, skatistan.org, in order to learn that it's actually in several countries now. And so it's really about education and skateboarding and trying to find these new ways to give girls the motivation and education and fun that they need access to. So I like that one, but I think I might give the edge, especially if we're leaning towards the American films, to St. Louis Superman, which I think I had heard about before. I think it was shown maybe at AFI Docs, and it's this for people for who the riots in Ferguson are still very top of mind. This is about this African-American guy whose family, he has all these ties to gun violence, and he's lost a lot to gun violence, and he's the father of a young black boy, and he wants better for his kid, and he's an activist during the Ferguson uprising riots that went on, and he becomes he joins the state House of Representatives in order to make a difference. And he pushes through this legislation to try and address gun violence and its impact on young African Americans in their community in the St. Louis area. And so I just think that that one could resonate.
It was my runner up. I really enjoyed watching it. He's got a message. It's really strong. It's kind of edge of your seat. You don't know what's going to happen with this guy. But, it's a really good watch. I also really enjoyed the South Korean. If you remember the South Korea ferry tragedy with a seawall a couple years ago where over 100 high school kids died because they listened to the captain and their teachers to not leave their rooms and evacuate. It's heartbreaking. It's 3 out of 5, but it's just a heartbreaking film. But there is one you can watch now. It's on Netflix. It's called Life Overtakes Me. And yeah, we were just talking about it before we started recording. Man, that could have been better.
It should have been better. Life Overtakes Me is about this weird illness that called resignation syndrome that's apparently impacted hundreds of kids in Sweden.
By the way, from no one has families. Ever heard of this thing. It floored me that this is a thing.
This is a thing that these kids suddenly fall into these comatose states for months or years, and they come from refugee families, and then, you know, their families have to like continue to feed them through feeding tubes, and these active kids that just suddenly just stop and are bedridden and unable to communicate and are in basically in a coma-like existence for months on end. This film does a terrible job of explaining where these people actually came from, what triggered and when these kids fell into this state. And one of them comes out of it, and the transition to her suddenly being out of it, they obviously did not catch any of that on film. They went back way too far after the fact, because you don't feel any sense of what happened, what was the trigger for this girl coming back to life, essentially. But it was one of those films where it could have been fascinating, and I wanted to learn more about this resignation syndrome and how and when, how many kids really do survive it, come through it, and what happens. But instead, it really just was a miss, you know, an unfortunate error in how the story was being told. And I liked when you talked about the one about based on the true story of the fairy. That one, In the Absence, I remember that story very well. And I remember seeing some of the snippets that so many kids now, you know, they all have their cell phones. And so there's footage from inside this fairy with these school children who think they're going to, you know, they're being told to just kind of shelter in place and hope that they're going to get rescued or that the ship will suddenly upright itself. And it is a tragic commentary on South Korea's terrible response.
It's a prime example disaster. Of government inefficiency, bureaucracy, stagnation.
And you're like hundreds.
Every single kid on this boat could have easily been saved with time to spare.
Yeah.
The captain of this ship should be, well, I think he's
he
in
was.
Prison.
He's in prison for life.
Should be raked to the coals.
I was shocked to, because I looked it up afterwards to discover that I really figured, oh, the captain probably committed suicide by now because you see him, he's the first to get off the boat and he survives and it's awful. And you just like, he just abandoned ship. And it's just, it is horrifying to see how the government was responding to that and how, you know, the optics were more important to the government than saving these people. They're like, oh my God, make sure we have a camera on the helicopter that gets out there to see what's happening with this ship. And there's a diver goes down and does something wrong with, is supposed to be trying to save people because the president's nearby and looking on, and underwater she can't see that he's not actually accomplishing anything that they later said, you know, that they pretend that he did accomplish. So yeah, it's a tragic story. And so that to me, I think that one was one of the strongest of the bunch.
Yeah, it's my third.
Yeah, but the one
we didn't talk about, which is Walk, Run, Cha-Cha, there's a reason we didn't talk about it. I guarantee you this will not win.
It won't win. Don't, you know, you can, if you're into like dancing, ballroom dancing or something, and just simple love stories, you might want to catch it someday if you're watching like the whole series of them. But no, it's sweet, it's short, and it's not going to win.
So I know we owe our listeners if we pick the winners, our... More accurately, if you want to win your Oscar ballot episode, tune in. We will tell you the most likely to win.
Or certainly the ones that we think will win and then the ones that we really wish would win. Because the two, you know, I always
it doesn't match.
I know, but I sometimes do two ballots. I do my dream ballot of what I really wish would win, and then I do the ballot of what I think will win.
Fair enough. The rhythm section stinks. But I want to go get, I'm going to go get a Stella tonight.
So it actually did, it accomplished something that it meant to accomplish, which I'm sure there's probably some integration deal that went on, and they're probably very happy that,
it works. It's not subtle.
You tapped into it.
Yeah. And the short films, pick your poison. I mean, it costs money to go each of these separately. In fact, I think the documentaries are split up into two because some of them are quite long, over 40 minutes. But date night always, the animated shorts always make for a fun date night. I used to do that before, life happened.
Yeah. No, and I do think that if you happen to live in near a theater that is showing, that is doing a screening of all of the shorts, I think they're surprising because you see just how, a lot of really interesting stories that you might not have been exposed to otherwise.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Cinema Clash. On behalf of The Cinema Clash, I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.